Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files and listen on your phone or personal computer. And when you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening. Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com. Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas, plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com.
Hey everybody, guess what? It's time for Survival and Beyond, and I'm your host, Ed Corcoran, and glad to be here broadcasting out on the Natural News Radio Network, as well as the Prepper Podcast Radio Network. Glad you all are listening, and you're here and tuned in, and coming here to get the truth, because that's what we do here. That's what I try to do. I try to bring the truth out to people, I try to bring out the preparedness and getting people aware of what to be prepared for, as well as preparedness skills and survival skills themselves. That's what we're all about. That's what Survival and Beyond is all about, folks. And there's a little bit of my radio personality coming out right there. I don't know if I could have practiced that. I had a crazy week this past week, man. Last week I did my shoot for the History Channel. Those of you who listen to my show on a regular basis, you've heard me talk about this program that's going to be on the History Channel called I don't know if I should mention the title on the air. Nobody ever gave me any guidelines about that, about what I can and cannot talk about. So I'll err on the side of caution, but I won't mention the title of the show just in case things happen to change or whatever. But anyway, yeah, they wanted to come down and interview me and have me demonstrate some survival skills, bushcraft skills, you know, wilderness type stuff, I guess. And I had a whole thing planned out. They were going to come up to New Hampshire, and I had all the I scouted out all these locations that just, you know, like pristine and, you know, insanely beautiful locations, and a little inconvenient to get to, which was my only concern. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, like it's not like it would have been impossible for them to heave their equipment up there. But yeah, unfortunately, there was a change of plans and some scheduling conflict or whatever. Like, they had to do an interview with somebody else and closer to the Boston area, and they asked me if I wouldn't mind meeting somewhere closer to Boston, so they didn't have to drive all the way the hills up north. And I don't blame them. You know, I don't blame them if they had two shoots to do that day. So I was accommodating. I said, sure. And oddly enough, they wanted me to do it, or they were asking me if I knew a place that that had a wooded area where they could use that as a backdrop for my interview. And so oddly enough, I ended up meeting them at my previous hometown down in Massachusetts, and met them down there, drove them out to the forest and everything like that. And we set up the shoot, and it was a little surreal. You know, I really haven't processed the whole experience yet. Still kind of a blur. And, you know, and when I was done with it, I didn't really have time to think about it too much because I've been busy as all get out. Oh, my God, I can't believe I just said busy as all get out. Next thing I'm going to start talking like a prospector pretty soon. But, yeah, you know, it's like I had this preconceived notion in my head about what it was going to be like. And I thought, you know, like, when I met them, it would be all like jaded and Hollywood and chop chop and, you know, and everything like that. But, you know, they were really nice guys, and you know, and I really felt comfortable around them. And I think they probably, you know, they do that. They ingratiate themselves and, you know, and listen to all of my, you know, had me regale them about, I, you know, started telling them about how our freedom was shanghaied from us by a bunch of fat, rich banksters and psychopaths on Jekyll Island, and, you know, and all this other stuff. And I didn't feel nervous. I didn't even think to feel nervous. I, you know, projecting into the future, I thought, you know, maybe I'm going to get a little nervous, and, you know, I've never done anything for TV or anything like that. But it really wasn't, you know, not a real TV show, you know, but it wasn't any different than doing any other, you know, video project. You know, it was, so, you know, I was like, I just kind of cruised through it, and, you know, I wasn't worried about them, you know. Well, I should take that back. What I was going to say is I wasn't worried about them making me look crazy. But I was still a little reserved about some things. And, you know, I was like, I just started talking, and, you know, they asked me, you know, they had a bunch of questions that they asked me. And so, you know, I was like, I went in. I couldn't really go into anything, into too much detail, because, you know, it's just a segment of the show, not the whole dang show. So, yeah, like, I was asked to, you know, elaborate on some things, and, you know, and it's really kind of a blur in my head right now. It kind of, it was an enjoyable experience, and, I don't know, maybe they will make me look like I'm crazy, but I don't care, because I told the truth, you know? And that's what's important. The truth is going to win out over crazy, or the perception of crazy. There, you know, there's going to be people out there who have the ears to hear the truth. And, you know, as long as those people are out there, then, you know, my message got across. You know, even if it was just one person, you know. So, you know, I just told the truth, and I didn't embellish it, and I didn't go into conspiracy theories, and I didn't, you know, I stuck to, you know, what I usually talk about is the stuff that's, you know, right there, right out in the open, that nobody's paying attention to. And God knows the mainstream media isn't saying a word about it. So, you know, somebody's going to get out there and do it. And I'm not saying, no, it's all on me. It's all the truth rests on my shoulders. It's, you know, there's lots of other people doing it too. And there should be more people doing it. The more people who are out there and being vocal and letting their voice be heard and standing up and saying, no, I will not have my rights infringed upon. You cannot do that. You cannot take my rights away from me. My rights are given to me by a higher power than any politician or army or whatever, you know. Say I'm a free person. I'm not a slave. I can see through your scam. I can see through your phony currency. I can see through all the games and the lies that you put on television. People have to do that. I don't know where that came from, but I feel really passionate about, well, actually, I do know where that came from. I feel passionate about liberty. I feel passionate about human rights. I feel passionate about resisting a globalist government, the New World Order, whatever it is you want to call it. It's there. It's real. It's in motion. It's manifesting in numerous ways every day. Not, you know, it seems like every time you turn around, you hear about some new executive order that's designed to take more of your rights and liberties away. Every day, from one corner of the whole mosaic, the whole, you know, picture, from one part or another, you know, while all the rest of the sheep run around in circles bickering about Republican and Democrat, Republican and Democrat, you know, like a couple of children, you know, grow up. Republican, Democrat doesn't matter. It's all the same. The two-party system is an illusion because the puppet masters are the ones who are there. The puppet masters are behind both of them. Those who do wield the true power, the corporations, that they're, you know, they're what's behind it all. The politicians are just puppets, and I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir when I say that, but I feel like I have to say it. You know, and we got Ron Paul, and by the time you folks are hearing this, the dust is probably settled about this whole the whole thing about Ron Paul dropping out of the race, you know, abandoning his campaign or whatever. You know, if you haven't heard yet, no, Ron Paul has not dropped out of the race. He's just redirecting his resources. You know, Dr. Paul knows what he's doing, folks. You know, he's focusing on delegates, which is more important right now. You know, don't forget that Ron Paul does not have the backing of Goldman Sachs and all Mitt Romney's billionaire buddies, you know. And it's an absolute, you know, railroad job. Back in 2009, when the Supreme Court ruled that corporations were no longer limited to the amount of campaign funds they can contribute to a candidate, I knew then that, you know, the electoral system is absolutely destroyed. You know, this is the Supreme Court, and this went largely unrecognized, you know. I heard about it maybe once in the media, in the mainstream media, and nothing after that. Didn't come across any discussion about it, about any, you know, no pundits or observers or, you know, critics. Nothing, you know, just like a lot of these executive orders, they fly by night, man. These things fly by night while you're sleeping. They fly on New Year's Eve when everybody's out partying. But, yeah, so the Supreme Court just says, you know, go nuts. You know, just donate as much money. And you know, and the corporations were very grateful for this because they no longer had to. I mean, they were still funneling the money to the candidate. They just had to do it in a more segmented way. You know, just funnel it through other subsidiary companies, you know. But now, you know, now that you know, they can just donate as much as they want. They just basically buy a candidate, you know. That's basically all. I mean, even Obama came out after this ruling and said that he didn't agree with it. He didn't support it. You know, and basically stating the words is like, now corporations can just simply buy a candidate. Well, you know, whatever that means or whatever that's worth, I don't know, because, you know, Obama's a, you know, the deceiver, he's the mastermind right now in the Oval Office, and things are being, he's orchestrating things in a way that are unsettling to me, and they should be unsettling to you if you're paying attention to it. You know, so now we've got Mitt Romney, billionaire, you know, funded by billionaires, you know, politicians, candidates who are campaigning, you know, it's like, you might as well just have logos on their suit lapels, you know, like, freaking NASCAR drivers, you know, 'cause they're being sponsored by corporate America. How much more do you need to see before you realize that this is not a republic? This is a corporatocracy, and it's a corporatocracy controlled by an oligarchy of international banks and financiers. And you know, and that's what it is. You know, that is the destructive force upon America. It's greed under a phony monetary system. And then once the value of that monetary system is taken away and the people are left just chasing the ghost, the representation of value rather than value itself, we get distracted, running on a treadmill, pursuing or trying to, you know, make ends meet and pursuing a life that becomes increasingly more and more difficult thanks to government intervention. So, you know, this is my rant, I guess this is turning into a rant. You know, I didn't intend for this to turn into a rant, but yeah, just to reiterate, yeah, Ron Paul right behind him. You know, I read the press release after the whole dust up about of course it, you know, if you believe that Ron Paul was dropping out of the race, you know, then you're probably, that's probably a good sign that you're watching too much mainstream media news. You know, because that's what the mainstream media, oh yeah, they won't ignore this, you know, they'll ignore everything else, they'll ignore all of Ron Paul's other accomplishments all throughout the campaign trail, but they're not going to ignore this. They're going to jump on and say, oh, Ron Paul admits defeat and Ron Paul drops out of race and blah, 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 and everything. That's all the mainstream spin on it, you know. But, you know, it was a calculated move, you know. You got to focus on the delegates, you know, the bound or the unbound delegates, because the bound may become unbound at some point and change their allegiance. But even the Ron Paul camp says that they, unless in the event of some unforeseen circumstances, they don't think that they're going to have enough delegates to get the nomination. But still, you know, it's a show of support, you know, and they're getting libertarians active in local and state politics, and you know, starting a groundswell, actually building a framework, you know, to return this country to the principles that we're supposed to be following. So, you know, more power to him. And you know what? Even it, you know, there's the possibility Ron Paul will run as an independent. And you know what? Even if he's not on the ballot at all, I'm going to write his name in. And I recommend everybody, all Ron Paul supporters, I don't need to tell you guys that. You all know that. You're all going to write his name in. I don't need to make a point of that. Don't even, I don't even know why I mentioned it. You all know. But for those of you who are on the fence, and if you're not a Ron Paul supporter, I sure would like to find out why. I wish you would tell me, because I can't see any, he is the only sensible choice. He's the only, unless you want more of the same, more Democrat-Republican, chasing each other around in circles, all doing the same things, all putting the globalist wheels in motion, unless you want more and more of that, you want that all the time, is that what you want for your children? You know, then by all means, go vote your party line, vote for Romney because he's a Republican. You know, screw that, you know, you're going to get more of the same. All you idiots who went and voted for Obama, now you're realizing that, you know, oh, maybe you made a mistake. You know, so you're going to switch the other side? No. And if you're an Obama apologist, if you're still walking around blaming Bush for the economy, for the recession, and, you know, and pointing out all of Obama's meager accomplishments, and you still can't see the truth, and you still can't see that it and if you're an Obama apologist and you're still running around blaming Bush for the recession and just and if you're an Obama apologist and you're still running around, you know, blaming Bush for the recession and pointing out any of Obama's minor accomplishments. I mean, I can't think of any. Well, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. Yeah, without doing a damn thing for world peace. And yeah, and then he just proceeds to become, excuse me, and then he just proceeds to become, you know, a war president. You know, maybe they ought to give him another Nobel Peace Prize. You know, if you can't see through all this stuff, then I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say to you if you're in the Obama denialist camp and you're, you know, it just boggles my brain cells whenever I come across people who are Obama supporters. I just don't get. I don't see how they don't get it. How they don't see they're so utterly conditioned and brainwashed, and you know, and the leftist liberal socialist mindset. I just don't understand it. I just don't understand how you could be so utterly enraptured and hypnotized past the point of reasonability, of you know, sanity. You know, we need liberty. We need liberty in this country, and we need to go back to the foundations that we started on, you know. And I don't even know where to start, you know. It's like I've got a couple of reports, the serious reports that I came across earlier today or yesterday, actually, and one story which is absolutely just mind-numbingly, you know, unbelievable. This is Nancy Genovese. This is a story of just like absolute abuse of police power. You know, and I want to start off, you know, like I have friends who are in law enforcement. I know a lot of people through the course of my work. I have interactions with law enforcement professionals all the time, and I am not anti-cop. And, you know, and I realize that, you know, there's a for all the bad cops that we see, you know, tasering elderly wheelchair bound women and utterly abusing their authority, you know, there for every one of those, you know, there's a number of cops who are out there doing a good job, doing you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing, protecting their communities, and doing the next right thing. And you don't hear about them, you know, that doesn't make it in the media, you know, it doesn't make it to the news. It's not a hot topic, you know. It doesn't make it on the internet when a cop does a good thing, when a cop helps somebody, when a police officer, you know, save somebody's life or makes a difference. You know, you never hear about that, you know. So there are a lot of good police officers out there. There's a lot of great law enforcement professionals who are looking out for us and taking care of us. The police are not our enemies. I don't want anybody to adopt that mindset that the police are enemies. You need to be wary when you deal with the police, for sure. I'm not saying that, you know, assume that every cop is trustworthy. I am not saying that at all. You need to have your wits about you, and you need to know your rights and know how to stand up for yourself. You know, so definitely, you know, don't let anybody try to step on your rights, even if they're wearing a badge. So I'm fully in support of that, but. You know, you hear about these other incidences, and I usually don't talk about this. This is a topic, you know, I tend not to want to bring up on the radio show. You know, it's like, all right, we can see all that stuff on the internet, you know, Florida cop, like I mentioned before, that's the one that sticks in my mind. You know, tasering or bullying or abusing, physically abusing, being physically abusive, and abusing their authority. You can see that stuff all the time, and I don't want to, I don't want to make a put a spotlight on it. But this particular, this particular event, or this chain of events, actually, is just it's really infuriating. And this is, like I was starting to say, Nancy Genovese is a woman who stopped in front of an airport in New York State, in Suffolk County, I believe it was. Yeah, Suffolk County, Grabowski Airport. She was driving home on County Road 31, and she's passing the airport, and they have a display of a helicopter. And it's just the shell of a helicopter, I guess. That's what I gather. Is they, you know, they call it a decorative, you know, on display or something like that. And she stopped to take a picture of it. And she took a couple pictures, and she was, she said she was going to post them on her support the troops wall or page, internet website or whatever. And she was getting ready to leave, and then she got stopped by a cop. Got stopped by town police, Lieutenant Eiberger, Robert Eiberger, I think that's how you pronounce his name, and he's a lieutenant with Southampton Town Police, and he stopped her and started asking her questions, asking her why she was taking pictures, and grabbed her camera, and you know, I guess he was like, you know, winging it around or something, you know, is because Nancy Genovese, she thought that he was going to break it, and she tried to get the camera away from him and everything, and she got her memory card out of it, and which was not returned to her. But then Lieutenant Eiberger demanded that she, you know, stay where she is, and he refused to allow her to leave. And, you know, the next thing you know, there's all this law enforcement showing up, there's the sheriff's office showing up, and there's the FBI and the airport security and Department of Homeland Security, you know, they all of these agencies just like activated for this woman taking a picture, you know, with her you know, point and shoot camera. They detained her for 6 hours on the side of the road. And while, you know, you've got a bunch of these law enforcement professionals walking to the FBI and DHS and everybody, you know, like bumping their noggins together and getting in each other's way. And after detaining her, they decided to arrest her for terrorism. Yeah. Yep. That was a charge. Actually, they did not even charge her when they arrested her. They did not charge her. They did not read her Miranda warning. She asked repeatedly to see an attorney, and her requests were denied. She was interrogated. She had a cut on her leg that she had suffered earlier that day. And, the police officer, he was calling it a knife wound. You know, an unreported knife. He charged her with having an unreported knife wound. She had cut her leg, and this is the other thing. It's like they detained her for so long, and it exacerbated the condition of the cut, and she was bleeding, and she asked repeatedly to be taken to a doctor to have it looked at, and all this other stuff, and they refused that, and all the while, this is the main point. They searched her car without her permission. And she happened to be at the gun range earlier that day at the rifle range, and she had a rifle, an unloaded rifle, in a locked case, which is absolutely legal in the state of New York. That is absolutely legal. It's for her to transport her rifle that way in a car. But of course, you know, oh, they made a big fuss about it. You know why? You know, because, oh my God, here's an informed citizen. Here's a person who supports their Second Amendment rights. You know, this is a person, you know, who owns a firearm, you know, and all of a sudden she became, oh, you know, the cops started calling her a teabagger, and it's like, oh, you one of those extreme right wingers, I'll bet. And, you know, and all of the cops were like joining in from the sound of it, from what that article seemed to convey. And Oh yeah, and by the way, I guess I should tell you what this article is from Mirtha and Mirtha attorneys at law website at mirthalawfirm.com. That's not a plug, by the way. I just want God forbid I ever start advertising lawyers on my show. That'll be the day I'd pack it in. You know, this is not a plug. I'm not recommending them or their services or anything like that. I'm just, this is where the article's at. If you want to go and read the full article about this horrific story, and it is a horrific story, and it doesn't end there. You know, they found the rifle, and it was just absolute harassment, jostling her around, you know, handling her roughly. Her leg's hurting. She's limping. So this all occurred on the roadside after 6 hours. Then she was brought in, and the cop who arrested her admitted, basically, Iberger admitted that that he had nothing to charge her with. But he said, "But I'll make something up. I'll make something up and teach all you right wing extremist teabaggers a lesson, you know." And just really, it was like vehemently, you know, opposed to, you know, assuming she's a right winger because she's got a rifle in her car and she was taking pictures outside of an airport, and which they later claimed that she had. That's too ridiculous for words. What they the press release that the undersheriff issued later on, but I'll get to that. That's towards the end of the story here. But yeah, she was interrogated, refused to allow her to speak to a lawyer. And then she's finally taken to the hospital after hours of this. And mind you, they were on the roadside until she didn't even get taken in until midnight. They were out on the side of the road until midnight for 6 hours. And finally, she gets some medical attention. When they get there, when they get to the doctors, the cops, these utter D-bags, I don't know what to call them, that's allowable on this network, but they stood there and watched her disrobe. They forced her to disrobe in front of them. And even the doctor was telling him, you know, turn away or leave the room, or, you know, and they just stood there and stared right at her while she had to take her clothes off to be examined. And so, it, you know, it was, she was given a prescription of antibiotics and told to take them on a very strict regimen, you know, every 3 hours or whatever it is. Otherwise, she would get an infection. They took her back to the jail. They refused to allow her antibiotics. So this wound eventually developed into a staph infection, which is pretty nasty. So she's back in jail. The next morning, they take her to the courthouse. They don't put a seatbelt on her. And again, the abuse, the verbal abuse, the physical, you know, they're just like shoving her around and stuff. You know, it's like she's some kind of, she's not a criminal. You know, it's like, and they charge her with terrorism. And so they take her to the court, and she's jostling around, and she's getting banged up inside the police van with no seatbelt on, and the driver's deliberately taking hard turns and hitting potholes, and they're laughing their asses off, you know, like they're big heroes, you know. And she gets to the court. Bail is set at $50,000, and you know, they don't have that kind of money for bail. So she ended up having to stay in jail after all of this, after being dragged through all of this and still, you know, suffering, wounded, you know, can't take her medicine, getting treated like scum. And finally, they send her a legal aid, and her legal aid attorney eventually quit. She quit. She showed up, told her that she could no longer be her attorney, and then recommended that that the woman be held under suicide watch for apparently no particular reason whatsoever. And then, of course, you know, there were more abuses that came with that. She had to wear a suicide gown, I guess is what they call it. I don't know what it is. I guess it's something like a straitjacket or something like that. And she was there for 3 days until they finally brought an honest-to-God psychiatrist to evaluate her. You know, she's in the rubber room, you know, because her court appointed legal aid lawyer, whatever that means, you know, she just didn't want to take the case or something and said, yeah, I think she's going to commit suicide. What, you know, that's not a diagnosis, you know, from some legal aid. I don't even remember if it was a man or a woman, but anyway. So finally the psychiatrist evaluates her. And this is the other thing too. When they hustled her into the protective custody, into the suicide watch, two guards grabbed her, carried her into this examination room. She was given two injections without her consent, and they held her head and her arm down so she couldn't see what they were doing, and she couldn't move her arm. And so she was injected with a substance that they would not tell her what it was, and completely against her free will. So she finally gets diagnosed, and the suicide watch is lifted. You know, the psychiatrist says she's not suicidal. You know, so finally she gets through this whole thing. Her sons, her 18 and 20 year old sons, manage to scrape up the bail money to get her out. And the undersheriff, Caracappa, I believe his name is, issued this press release. You know, with all this hyperbole on all these exaggerated claims, like they said that she had surveillance equipment in her car, and that she was taking photographs of the airport and the security, and you know that she had 500 rounds of ammunition in her car, and you know, and just like really overblown. They said that, you know, she'd been kicked off the airport a couple of times before and told not to come back, which was absolutely not true. And this is the thing. She wasn't even on airport property when this whole thing went down. She didn't even set foot on airport property. She was out on a public street, and she was taking a picture of what was left of a helicopter, some kind of display, you know, and she was going to go on her merry way home with her two sons. And all of this happened, you know, she got labeled arrested for terrorism. You know, I didn't know that you could do that. I didn't know that terrorism was now a crime. I assume it's a felony. I would imagine. But, you know, this is like the new witch hunt, isn't it? All you had to do was like point your finger and go, witch! And then the next thing you know, there'd be a hearing, and they would examine the woman for unusual spots or moles or birthmarks or any kind of identifiable factors that will prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that she's a witch, other than dunking her in a dunking chair. And if she drowns and she's not a witch, and if she floats and she's a witch, and they burn her at the stake, and, you know, yada, 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 all down that. Now what all you have to do is just point and holler, terrorist. You know, and the FBI comes out, and DHS comes out, and the sheriff, and the town, and the county clerk, and the local magistrate, and the Lord Mayor, and everybody comes out, and it's just like such an enormous waste of resources. You know, how is that? Has the war on terror is going just as well as the war on drugs, just the way the government wants them to? You know, they're both great successes. Don't you know that? And speaking of the war on terror, the whole push towards surveillance drones over America is moving forward. The whole deal, if you haven't heard about this, the government is pushing for 30,000 unmanned surveillance drones to be patrolling the skies of America looking for terrorists. Yeah. And they're actually encouraging local police departments and sheriff's departments to utilize drones. And some of them have plans to actually weaponize them, mount tasers on them, or you know, shotguns, or you know, whatever. I mean, yeah, you can put a weapon on it. I mean, the United States military has been using unmanned drones to great effect in the Middle East and in the Middle East theater. You know, oh, never mind all the civilians and the children that they kill. You know, it's like you're just out there flying your plane remote control like playing a freaking video game. You know, so this is what they want for Americans. This is absolutely what they want for Americans. They want the spy in the sky, and you know, and Big Sis Janet Napolitano is going to come out and tell everybody that, you know, stay calm and don't worry. If you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have anything to worry about, right? If you're not doing any, if as long as I'm not doing anything wrong and I've got nothing to worry about, how many times have I heard that? Boy, oh boy, trying to wake people up. And, you know, I don't know why people can't wake up. You know, some people, why they just cannot see what's going on right under their own nose. You know, I was thinking about the other day. I mean, you know, I always talk about the intricate web and, you know, the many connections and, you know, and how this network, it's difficult to explain to people, you know, all at once. You know, you can only give them like little pieces of it, parts of it, and eventually just keep building on that until, you know, you've developed a clear enough picture in their head that they can understand the bigger picture. You get them to take a few steps back from it so they can see it, you know, more in its entirety. But, you know, that's not even necessary. You know, it's not even necessary to explain all of these intricacies and the ins and outs and the Bilderbergers and the, you know, the Rothschilds and the Federal Reserve and how everything's tied together and, you know, the corporate oligarchy and all that. It's not really necessary. It shouldn't be to alarm the general public, you know, general Americans. I mean, look at all the pieces and add them all up and see. I wrote about this on my blog, by the way, on the radio show's website. It's survivalandbeyond.net. And I'm bringing news about, you know, libertarian issues about our freedom as well as, you know, survival and preparedness content. There's all kinds of downloads. I'm always adding new downloads to the directory and, you know, ebooks and guides and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff up on there and there's videos and, you know, and all that. And I'm working hard on it. So anyway, this is something that I wrote about on the website. And if you add all of the things up from the USA Patriot Act on forward, what kind of picture develops for you? You know, there's the Patriot Act, and then that led to NDAA, the indefinite detention of American citizens, or, you know, anybody, everybody, including American citizens. And then there's the National Defense Resources Act, where, you know, basically the government can roll in and take control of anywhere. You know, any resources, you know, come in and take over your town, you know, take over your county, you know, take whatever they want. That's what Obama has written himself the license to do. He has endowed himself with so many special powers, you know, with executive orders. Like I said, you know, every time you turn around, there's a new executive order, there's new, some new agency, there's some new regulatory agency, or there's some, you know, non-governmental organization trying to go out to rural America and tell them what's what and let Monsanto run roughshod. Oh, that reminds me, too. Speaking of Monsanto, this is another one of my constant concerns is the food supply, you know, and the safety. Actually, it's not safe. Our food supply is not safe. It's under control of big agriculture. But speaking of Monsanto, I came across a news piece from Poland. Apparently, you know, in Poland, they managed to ban Monsanto's genetically modified organisms, you know. And this ties into another interesting story, too. But in Poland, all these beekeepers, they all organized because all the bees are dying. The bees are dying from eating this genetically modified corn that's designed to produce its own BT toxin as a pesticide to keep insects off. Well, the problem is that it's poisoning the bees, you know, the pollen and whatnot. And so all these bees are dying. And this has been an ongoing thing. You know, this has been the whole bee die-off thing has been an issue. People started noticing this a few years ago, and nobody knew what it was. Nobody knew what the why they were dying. But I'll tell you what. If the bee population dies out or is severely diminished, then that could be an extinction level event. If the bee population is gone, we're screwed because we count on bees to to cross-pollinate and to, you know, keep our crops going. And I'm not an agriculturist or anything like that, so I can't speak about it with a, you know, a great deal of eloquence or alacrity. But yeah, they're a vital part of the ecosystem, you know. And when the bees die, then the crops die, then the food animal, the cows and everything else dies, you know, and all the way up the chain, right up to humans. So, you know, and the worst thing about it is that Monsanto knew about the effects that their crops would have on bees. They actually purchased, they bought a research company that was actually involved in the study of the BT toxin produced by Monsanto's genetically modified corn and what the, you know, measuring the effects of it that it was having on bees. Well, they bought that company, so don't expect any more good science coming out of there, any more, you know, unbiased research coming out of this company. And I'm failing to remember the name of it. I should have written it down. I usually take a lot of notes and everything before I do my show with all my research, but I'll get around to posting that on the website. So, you know, you can come and check the website out. I'll have the story up on the website. But anyway, yeah, so Monsanto is fully well aware that their genetically modified corn was killing off the bees. The BT toxin was killing the bees. But, you know, hey, they go ahead and do it anyway. This is what I mean when I say that there are psychopathic people in charge, right? Monsanto is basically, you know, they can do whatever they want, you know, because the FDA, and I've mentioned this before, and it bears repeating, the FDA is infiltrated on its highest levels with CEOs or former or executives from big agriculture and the pharmaceutical industry. They, you know, that agency is bought and paid for. The industry is allowed to regulate itself, and it's not, you know, it doesn't even function as any kind of protective agency anymore. And they knew this. This is the pernicious thing, you know, and of course they know what effect that a die off of the bee population would have, you know. But they're doing it anyway, you know. They're fully aware of all the evil they perpetrated throughout the world since the turn of the 20th century. In 1911 or 1912, I think it's when they were founded. And, you know, if they can do this in Poland, if they can get at the gumption to affect change and get genetically modified organisms banned in their country, why can't we do it here in America? This is what we're all about, people. We're all about freedom. We're all about protecting our rights, protecting each other's rights. You know, we can't even get genetically modified food labeled in this country because everything is controlled. Everything is manipulated, right? You know, right down to the judicial branch, you know. The judicial branch was my last holdout of all the branches of government as being the least corrupted, you know. But I was wrong about that too, you know. I was naive about that. You know, the judicial system is corrupt. It's all corrupt. There is not a bastion or a holdout of decency or common good or any kind of noble motive or you know, it's just you have to start it all over again. You said there's no reform, there's no amount of reform. You know, sometimes I'm in favor of reforming the GOP and, you know, or whatever, and it's like it's not going to matter because it's all the whole mechanism is built the way it is for a reason. And it needs to be thrown away. It needs to be thrown away and started all over again, you know. And that's what you call revolution. And it doesn't. And I'm not a proponent of violent revolution. I'm not a proponent of. I don't want a single person to get hurt or killed. I call for a revolution of the mind, revolution of, you know, awakening. You know, get people to wake up and stand up for, you know, exercise their rights. You know, exercise the rights that they have, that they're given. And, Getting back to, going off on a tangent again, but, getting back to the original point that I was getting at, trying to wake people up, you don't have to paint this grand, broad picture, actually. And this is something that occurred to me, a week or so ago, is that you start looking at the NDAA, USA Patriot Act, the Resources Act, all of the things, the drones, the 30,000 drones that are being approved, the buy-up of 450 million rounds of hollow point 40 caliber ammunition by the Department of Homeland Security, ostensibly for target practice. Really. Look at everything that's going on. All the pieces are being laid in place that are going to take away our freedom, our rights, what freedom we have. And let's face it, folks, it ain't much left. we're slaves to a system. We're slaves to a monetary system that doesn't exist. It's a fantasy. It's vapor. Whatever wealth that you seem to think you have is an illusion. And when they pull that rug out from under you, and they will, when they finally decide to dismantle this facade, this pretense called the U.S. dollar, when it's been utterly valueless for decades, it's been utterly valueless. It was backed by silver until the Nixon administration, and they detached the U.S. dollar from even silver, and from that point forward, it's just been an instrument that is not even an instrument. It has no value. It can't do anything. It's all a game. It's all an illusion. It's all a ride, as Bill Hicks would say. And people just need to shake off those shackles and shake off, snap out of the dream. The American dream only exists if you're asleep. You have to be asleep to believe it. But, you add all these things up, and I'm sorry, I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place, and, I just get so much stuff spinning around in my head that I want to get out, and every time I finish a show and I wrap it all up and everything's all buttoned up and uploaded and ready for public consumption, I was thinking of all the things that I forgot to say, It's like, oh, geez, damn, I forgot to mention that, and I forgot to mention this. And so there's so many things that I want to get out, and sometimes all of these things kind of can bottleneck sometimes. But I always seem to find my way back on track eventually. So here I go again. You line up all of these things that I'm talking about, all these blatant acts to remove, to grant power, more power to the government and take more freedom away from us. And when the economy finally reaches its logical conclusion in total collapse, and it was engineered that way, folks. It's completely under control. But they're finally gonna say, all right, we're gonna just dismantle the U.S. dollar. Maybe it'll come as a result of some kind of if China. Or if the world at large decides to stop using the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, that'll send us into utter chaos. Right now, there's a run on banks in Greece, right? And this is all connected as well. Everybody's pulling all their money out of the bank in Greece. And when the other countries in the EU start to follow suit, it's going to be a cascade of effect. Next Italy, the banks will be going under in Italy because people will be taking all their money out, and in Spain, and Greece doesn't look like they're going to accept any more austerity measures. It doesn't look like they're going to accept a bailout from the European Union. And so ostensibly Greece is no longer going to be part of the EU, and that'll have all kinds of repercussions. And so these things are going to happen. It's gonna like circle around the world, and eventually it's gonna hit America. And either the bottom's gonna fall out, or somebody's gonna pull the bottom out. Whatever it is, it's going to happen. There's no, absolutely no way whatsoever that we could ever put a dent in our debt, in our national debt, you know, not in a million years. And you just can't keep raising the debt ceiling and manipulating inflation and everything. The house of cards, it's a pyramid scheme. You know, it's eventually going to collapse. It's doomed to failure. And when that happens, I'm afraid that there's a story also that I have up on survivalandbeyond.net, a story about some prognosticators, some social critics anticipating a civil war in the United States. And God, I hope it doesn't come to that, you know, but there are a lot of people like Gerald Celente, trends forecaster, and uncannily accurate trends forecaster. He's been hollering for years. I've been watching his videos. I'm not like a constant follower of Gerald Celente, but you know, I do listen to what he has to say every now and then. And he's very over the top and he's very extreme. And I think he's very passionate. I think he's very serious. I don't think he's doing this. I don't think anybody who's doing this is doing this just to give people the willies. You know, I don't want to frighten anybody. I want to empower everybody and get people talking and spread more of the truth, because, you know, there's too many times you hear people say, well, what can I do? I'm only one person. Well, you know, if enough of those people who said, what can I do? I'm only one person, actually did something, then you have, you know, millions of people affecting change. You know, realize that we're all connected. We're all in this together. We have the power. We have the power because there's more of us, really. You know, we don't have to take this. We don't have to lull ourselves into a sense of stupefied complacency and just, you know, accept it and turn a blind eye to it and, you know, continue to medicate yourself and allow yourself to be brainwashed. That's going to change. Whether it's either going to change of your own volition while you still have time to do something about it. You know, this is why we do this. We do this to give you a heads up, give you a warning so you can get prepared. You know, we don't do this. Gerald Celente doesn't do this to give you the willies. I don't do this to give you the willies. Nobody's doing this. Alex Jones isn't doing, well, maybe Alex Jones is kind of doing it to give you the willies, but it's to give you a heads up, a wake up call, so you can do something about it while you still can, and so you can mobilize and you can learn what more you can do. You know, everybody should be. I would love it if, you know, I always recommend people to start their own radio show. You know, it's not that hard. You can start on a small scale. You don't have to be part of a huge network. You can go on Blog Talk, and you know, there's a free, you can have a show for free. You know, it's only, they only let you have 30 minutes, but you know, it's a start, you know, and don't worry about what you're going to say. I mean, listen to me. I'm a freak. You know, I come on this radio show and I stutter and I stammer and I trip over my words and I change gears in mid-sentence, and I am not the polished product of any kind of broadcast training whatsoever, you know, and it's hard for me to, you know, go back and do the edit, you know, which I never had to do before because I always did a live show, but I have to go back and do the edit, and I want to take out, like, all of the awkward, like, ums and ahs and everything. So don't worry about it. I mean, you know, no one's more surprised than I am that people dig my show. And I'm constantly flattered and grateful for that, for my listeners, you know. And I have a lot more listeners than I ever thought I would have. And so, you know, people seem to like to hear what I have to say. And I hope that's the case. And I just want to encourage other people to get active in some way. You know, sitting around and complaining about it and hollering about it and ranting about it, all that stuff is very visceral, and it's very gratifying in its own way, but you've got to do more. You know, but a good place to start is just to try to spread your message, spread the truth as far and wide as you possibly can. You know, you always hear people talking about the dangers of the internet and how our privacy and our identity and our habits and, you know, fall under the scrutiny of the Department of Homeland Security. They're watching where we go, what websites, and reading our emails, and all thanks to the Patriot Act. And you know, and everybody's cautious about Facebook and, you know, whether it's a CIA, you know, front. And if Zuckerberg is the great grandson of David Rockefeller or whatever, you know, that the conspiracy theory is, you know, of all of the fears that we have about the internet, right? I think it's often neglected that the internet is also our greatest weapon. It's also our greatest tool, I should say, of change. You know, with the internet, we have access to such a great resource of communication. You know, and it should not be underutilized. While it is still to us, while the internet is still to us, we should absolutely utilize it to its fullest potential. There's my sermon, I guess, is what it turned into. I'm looking at the clock, and we're running out of time. We got to go to a commercial break, unfortunately. You know, we got to pay the bills. And when we come back, we're going to have Scott B. Williams, who is the renowned author of what many consider the definitive book on bugging out called Bug Out. And he's also going to talk about his new book, Bug Out Vehicles and Shelters. And so when we come back, I've had him on my old show before, and he's a good friend of mine, and it's always good to have him on the show. So we'll be back with Scott B. Williams right after this break.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files and listen on your phone or personal computer. And when you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening. Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com. Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas, plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com.
Hey, and we're back, and you're listening to Survival and Beyond on Natural News Radio. And check out the site at Natural News if you haven't yet. I know a lot of our listeners are Natural News fans, and you're all about that stuff. But some of our listeners, we're going out to other networks on the Prepper Podcast Radio Network. And if you haven't checked out Natural News, I highly recommend that you do. I've been a big fan of Natural News for years, and that they're at naturalnews.com. And you can check out the radio at naturalnewsradio.com. And also, while you're at it, check out my website, survivalandbeyond.net. On Survival and Beyond, we've got all kinds of great information, content, downloads. I'm putting up downloads almost every day with all kinds of homesteading, self-reliance, survival, preparedness, just the whole gamut. And you want to check back there every day because there's always something new on there, including news and reports on the things that affect your survival, your freedom, your liberty. And it's a great time, folks. So a lot of people, it's pretty popular. A lot of people are getting a lot of great comments about it. And I want to thank everybody who's contacted me and shown their appreciation for the site. So that's survivalandbeyond.net. Now, without further delay, we're going to get to our guest. And tonight we have Scott B. Williams. And he's the author of what many consider to be the definitive bug out guide that he published a while back, called Bug Out. And his most recent book, Bug Out Vehicles and Shelters, is now out on the shelves, and it's been out for a bit now. It's getting a lot of good positive reviews. And Scott is also an author of several other books, everything from kayaking to survival stories, and he's currently working on another book right now, but we'll get into that later. Right now, I'd like to introduce Scott to the show. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Great, Ed. Thanks for having me here.
Oh, thanks for being on, man. You know, I really dig your work, and I try to put out the word about your books as much as possible.
I appreciate that, yeah.
So, Bug Out Vehicles, I mean, this is a book that a lot of people have been waiting for, they've been interested in. A lot of people geek out, and myself included. You know, I'm a big geek when it comes to, like, modifying vehicles and stuff like that, and there are some things that I've done in my experience, and I just wanted to get some of your insights because you really cover a lot of ground with this book, and, you know, since most people are really into, like, the motor vehicle aspect of bugging out, I figured that would be a good place to start. So, when we're talking about bug out vehicles, I guess we'll start from, like, you know, square one and say, like, what you have already. Your SUV or your minivan or whatever, you know, that's in like the bare knuckle situation, that's what you're going to have to deal with. But what would you recommend as far as, you know, a bug out vehicle? There are certain considerations that you have to make in terms of, like, whether you're thinking of an EMP event and all that kind of stuff. So I'm just going to stop babbling. I'll let you take it from there. And what are the things that you look for?
Yeah, great. First of all, in putting this book together, obviously I could have easily written an entire book just on motor vehicles or just one specific type of motor vehicle, actually, but I had to make a decision about that, and what I chose to do instead is to, you know, cover a broad spectrum of vehicles, everything from motor vehicles to human-powered land and water vehicles and other types of watercraft as well. So the book does cover, you know, a wide variety of topics, so that there's not a lot of, you know, in-depth focus on one particular type of vehicle, because I wanted to present all the different options out there that people could tailor for their individual situation depending on where their location is to begin with and where they're, you know, maybe bugging out to and what kind of event they may be preparing for. So that has a big mm-hmm. bearing on it. But when it comes to motor vehicles, as you said, the first consideration probably is that, you know, just about everyone has a motor vehicle already that they use for their everyday life, you know, going to work and whatever they have to do every day, transportation. So obviously that vehicle that you already have, you know, will probably be, in many cases, that might be your bug out vehicle, because not everyone can afford to buy a purpose-made bug out vehicle or equip one, you know, specifically for that purpose. They just want to, you know, kind of optimize the vehicle that they have and use every day, you know, and think about some considerations that might make it, you know, better. And I suppose the number one consideration would be to make sure that it's properly maintained and reliable and that you could absolutely depend on it to start and to get you where you're going when you need it.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't take too much into consideration. You know, people, and I'm as guilty as anybody else, you know, when there's a problem, well, then you fix it. But,
yeah.
it's important to keep the vehicle maintained. Always keep at least most people recommend at least a half a tank of gas in your car at all times, if not more.
Right.
What are some of the other things that you want to look out for that, you know, oftentimes get past people's attention?
Well, just making sure that your electrical system's up to par. You know, your battery is good, and that you have spare tires and tools, to do minor repairs and, extra parts that you may need. In fact, in the book, I have a checklist of, just basic and some more in-depth, parts and tools that should be carried in every vehicle. And probably, the average person probably does not carry all these tools and spare parts with them every day. But it's certainly something to think about, to be sure that you can, get back on the road. And then also thinking about how you would clear obstructions or get out of situations like being stuck or having to move some obstacle out of the road, that sort of thing. Things like, bolt cutters, for instance, in case you have to cut through, a chain or a gate or something, to get around some locked area that you can't, that you wouldn't be able to get through otherwise, or a winch to pull, logs or other kinds of roadblocks out of the road, jacks to get out of, different situations where you may be stuck, and shovels, chainsaw to cut trees out of the way. I mean, there's a lot of things like that you could add that can really increase the capacity, of an ordinary vehicle to get through obstructions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good advice. Now, what other items do you want to keep in your car at all times? There's tools and stuff like that. There's a lot of people that don't even have jumper cables in their car, or just the items that you need for just an ordinary run of the mill roadside emergency, car jack,
right.
Lug wrench and things like that. Now apart from those mundane items, which I don't think they really require mentioning, although obviously it does, because a lot of people just don't have those things. But in terms of thinking in a scenario where you're going to be leaving your home and you don't know when you're coming back, and what are the kind of items that you carry in your car at all times in terms of with a survival mindset?
Well, as far as the actual for the vehicle itself to keep the vehicle going, or for actual survival, I mean, you got to have your, of course, your bug out gear, if you're planning on, surviving out of the car. But as far as the vehicle itself, just other things that people may not think of. I mean, almost everybody has a spare tire, for instance, but what about a tire repair kit, a plug kit, or a tube repair kit, or an air compressor, so that you can actually repair, a tire if you have more than one flat, that sort of thing. And, spare bulbs and, duct tape and, baling wire, JB welds, zip ties, all these sorts of things to, that you might could use to affect repairs on the vehicle beyond just your ordinary, everyday things that people would have, in normal life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those kinds of things I could tell you from personal experience. A few years back, I was driving my car and my whole exhaust system fell out.
Yeah.
And it, unbeknownst to me, it was a beater car, and it was something I didn't really spend a whole lot of time thinking about maintenance on. And I was on the highway, and the whole thing, a muffler, the exhaust pipe, everything just came loose. And I happened to have a length of Ethernet cable,
yeah,
in my trunk. And I used that to tie up the muffler. Now, if I didn't have that, and it was pure happenstance that I did, it was about 30 feet of cable. I just threw it in my trunk and forgot about it. But if I didn't have that, then I would have been in a lot more trouble. And I just, thank that, I was fortunate. And ever since then, I've made sure that I keep things like you mentioned, like zip ties and cordage and all kinds of other items that, you can improvise repairs if you need to. And you can go off, you can think half the day and still come up with all kinds of little odds and ends that'll be good to have around.
Oh, yeah, sure. You can always carry extra fasteners, nuts and bolts and screws, and an 18-volt drill or something, so if you needed to drill a hole to set a screw or something like that, there's just, it can really be endless, as far as how much stuff you could actually carry, but, you have to kind of draw the line somewhere and and kind of base it on, you know, what you think, you know, the most likely scenarios might be. But but for a serious bug-out vehicle, I would recommend carrying, you know, dive belts and things like that. You might even want to consider carrying spare spark plugs and plug wires, maybe even an alternator, a second battery, you know, maybe even a starter. I mean, all these things, if you're expecting just a total, you know, bug-out scenario where you don't know how long the situation may last. Mm-hmm. But that's just up to the individual, you know, and what they're preparing for and how long they expect to actually leave the, you know, use the vehicle. A lot of people are only going to use the vehicle to get out of the danger zone, and then they're not going to be, you know, planning to rely on the vehicle beyond that point. So, you know, none of us really know what type of scenario we're going to have to face and how long we may be able to even use the vehicle or if fuel is going to be available at all. You know, so that's another whole consideration. You know, what are you going to do about fuel resupply and how much fuel can you store and where are you going to store it?
Mm-hmm.
And are you going to be able to get any more at all? You know, a lot of this, you know, this book and my previous books comes from, you know, the experience that I had right here in Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina, you know, seeing, you know, what it was like to be in an area where there was no fuel available for weeks, you know, and all the gas pumps, you know, completely out of operation. The power was out, and, you know, most of them were pumped empty anyway, you know, even if they could pump. So, you know, there was no fuel. And, you know, pretty much, you know, caused chaos, you know, in the aftermath of that. And, you know, a lot of things happened because of that.
Sure. And if you're survival-minded at all and you're thinking in terms of bug-out and you're driving a Honda hatchback or something like that, then you're probably going to want to consider replacing that vehicle with something that's got a little more storage. You get more room for stuff. It's a little hardier, durable, able to traverse more rugged terrain. And there is also, you know, a whole other things like I touched upon at the introduction or earlier in the interview. You know, about EMP. A lot of people are talking about, as far in terms of a bug out vehicle, getting something that's older, that doesn't have any electronic components to it, no electronic fuel injection or ignition or things like that. And what are some of the things that you would recommend that people look for in an older vehicle or bug out vehicle?
Yeah, just that. I mean, you know, no electronic, you know, complicated electronic systems. That's going to be your number one thing if you're concerned about EMP. You know, and then, you know, another thing to look for in vehicles is, you know, you want towing capacity so that you could, you know, tow a trailer. If you're going to be pulling, like, your alternative vehicle or extra gear, you know, behind the main vehicle, you may want the ability to tow, you know, a utility trailer at the very least, or maybe even an RV or some other kind of mobile retreat, which I talk about in one of the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, towing capacity is always a good thing. But even if you did have to use something like a Honda hatchback or some small car, or a light truck, you know, cargo racks on the roof are a great addition. That's something that I always point out, you know, in these interviews and also on my blog, you know, that people should consider putting some kind of cargo racks, you know, like the kind of carriers that you see, you know, for carrying canoes or ladders, you know, contractor-type racks. Or, you know, there's all sorts of racks available, and these greatly increase the capacity of any vehicle, you know, to carry alternative and backup vehicles, like if you carry bicycles, kayaks, or canoes on those racks, as well as, you know, additional gear, you know, in backpacks or dry bags or something. So it really expands the versatility of any vehicle, and especially if you have a family, you know, you have more passengers in your vehicle and you don't have the space inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to bear in mind, too, that you're going to be taking a lot of other gear, like food and, you know, possibly fuel, if you can manage to wedge in some fuel containers in there.
Yeah, and if you can carry your fuel on the outside of the vehicle, that's always good. You know, if you have a rack to carry jerry cans, that's, you know, usually the safest way to carry it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of storing fuel, you know, I've heard horror stories about, you know, storing fuel on the outside in the wake of Katrina, where,
right,
you know, you don't, if you're going to store it outside of your vehicle, you want to make sure it's concealed, that, you know, nobody can,
exactly,
yeah, so, you know, people aren't going to walk up and just take it right off of your truck or car. In terms of expense, I've been finding that it's, since the Cash for Clunkers, that whole fiasco took place, it's a lot harder to find some good, reliable used cars anymore, because they've all been, or a large majority of them have been turned in and destroyed. I guess what I'm getting at is if you can't get something that's pre like 1979 or wherever the cutoff point is, I guess it depends on the make and model of the car. Then you're pretty much going to be stuck with something that has electronic fuel injection and ignition and all that. If you have to, if you have to go that route, then what would you recommend as far as like, you know, say an early 80s or, you know, newer type vehicle? What are some of the standouts in your mind?
Well, one thing to remember, if you do have to go that route and you're not going to be, you know, going back to the pre-EMP, you know, the EMP-proof type vehicles, then you might go ahead and consider getting the newest vehicle that you can get, because in general, you know, a lot of the newer vehicles are just flat out more reliable than older vehicles, you know, especially from the 80s. You know, as everybody knows, you know, the technology has improved, although they're a lot more difficult to work on, and, you know, in a lot of cases, there's really nothing you can do when they break down on you, but the chances of that happening are a lot slimmer, so that's just one thing that, you know, to throw in there. But
That's the balancing point I'm at right in terms of that is like, well, yeah, older cars are easier to work on, and so I guess I'm like stuck in that mold there. But yeah, the newer cars are probably better built, especially, you know, the cars in the 80s don't have a really good reputation. But sorry, I just
I've had great luck with like the older 80s models. Toyota with a 22R engine, you know, the tough Toyota pickups, four-wheel drive and the two-wheel drive. You know, I've had a couple of those that I've put over 300,000 miles on, and they're
so very
simple. Yeah, they're very, very reliable, simple, trucks, and they're getting harder to find, though. You know, back a few years ago, you could find good deals on them, but they're kind of few and far between these days. But those are good, you know, and I've also had good luck with some of the Ford vehicles, like the F-150 pickup. You know, if someone's needing a full-size pickup, you know, a lot of the newer models especially are great trucks. But you know, there's just so many different specific vehicles out there, it's hard to, recommend a particular vehicle. I did have some examples in the book, you know, of different types, because I kind of break it down into the categories of, you know, just ordinary sedans and then pickups and SUVs and some of the crossovers. So, there are some point out there. And things like, you know, SUVs, like the Nissan Xterra, you know, is a pretty capable four-wheel drive SUV that's pretty readily available out there. And, that's one thing to consider. The older Jeep Wranglers are pretty rugged, you know, four-wheel drive, you know, if you want that type of capability. Mm-hmm. I would try to stay away from some of the biggest, you know, heaviest and most expensive kind of vehicles. Because one thing, the really big vehicles are going to be more limited as to where they can go off-road. You know, a lot of the guys that are real serious about off-roading will tell you that, you know, they try to stay with, some of the smaller vehicles that can get into places the big ones can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I think everybody's wet dream about a bug-out vehicle would probably be like a Deuce. You know, or deuce and a half, or monstrous military truck. When I was in Utah at the Self Reliance Expo, there's a fellow there, and he pulled up in this modified, I believe it was a deuce and a half, and oh boy, it was great. You know, it's like it was awesome. Yeah. I loved it. But then, yeah, you start thinking about the practicality of it. It's like, you know, well, you're gonna have, if you're having to maneuver in and out of tight spots and everything, then you're pretty much gonna be, you know, roadblocked with a big honking truck like that. And so, yeah, bigger isn't always necessarily better when you're thinking about bugging out, especially in escaping, you know, a situation.
Yeah, and then there's also the fuel economy too. You know, your range is gonna be determined by your fuel economy, and what you have is probably all you're gonna get, you know, as far as fuel. So whatever you live with is what you're gonna deal with.
Right. Now, in terms of thinking of smaller and in terms of maneuverability and all that, you have a whole section on motorcycles, dual sport motorcycles, four wheels, and things of that nature. You want to tell us a little bit about that, what your thoughts are?
Yeah, you know, I have a lot of personal experience with the dual sport motorcycles. Well, you know, they definitely have their place. I mean, they're not, you know, obviously they're not going to be the solution for everyone, but there are some advantages, you know, major advantages and major disadvantages, you know, of using a motorcycle as a bug-out vehicle. You know, one of the advantages, of course, is that you can, go places that no four-wheel vehicle could go, you know, off-road in some situations, and also they're very easy to conceal when you get where you're going, you know, or even in the the city or wherever you're keeping it before you leave. You know, you can store a motorcycle in the smallest building or even inside your house, or and then when you get to the woods somewhere, it's easy to cover it up and leave it if you had to leave it, for some reason. So they have some advantages. They also have great fuel economy, and the dual sports in particular can travel on the interstates and any other highways within at highway speeds, and then still have the ability to go off road and get into some pretty gnarly places, depending on the design of the bike. So I think they have their place, for people that are. But I wouldn't recommend, someone that has no experience at all with motorcycles to, to just immediately start with that as the bug out vehicle. I think it takes some time to, get familiar with it and do some, off-roading and some camping off the motorcycle, do some traveling and see, work out a system of how you can carry your gear and, how you're going to carry your gear and how much you can carry and that sort of thing, because it is going to be more limited as far as what you can carry.
Right. Yeah, it's really a tough call. I mean, when I think about escape vehicles, bug out vehicles, and you can't really put all your eggs in one basket, because you don't know what kind of situation you're going to be in. Oftentimes, like if you're in an urban situation and you need to get out, and the highways are gridlocked and it's just a big long parking lot and everything, then yeah, it'd be advantageous to have a dual sport bike, and you can weave in and out of the cars and make your way through. I like the fact of about fuel consumption. And speaking of fuel consumption, what about dual or tri-fuel type configurations? Have you experienced any like the diesel burning vegetable oil or other alternative type fuels? Is there anything about that you recommend?
I mean, I think the point about a diesel engine, that's certainly a consideration if you're preparing for a total, end of the world as we know it type scenario, where you may not be able to get any more refined gasoline, for the foreseeable future. So that does give you that ability, of diesel, the ability to burn biodiesel would be something. Again, it just depends on what you're preparing for. If you're just preparing on a quick get out of Dodge situation, or if you're expecting to have to endure a long-term scenario like that, I think, that's something to consider as well. And, the military, speaking of the dual sport motorcycles, the Kawasaki KLR 650 is one of the most popular, the one that I have, currently. But the U.S. Marines has the diesel version of that same bike. It's not available for the civilian market, but they do have a diesel version of the KLR 650, which they use in some operations. So,
oh, really?
They are in existence. I'm not sure how the difficulty of getting one, but they are out there. The Marines use them.
I don't really think of diesel in terms of motorcycles often.
Right. Yeah, I don't know of any civilian, just motorcycles off the shelf that come, equipped with a diesel engine.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know they build that KLR that way.
Now, here's a debate that continues to rage on as far as in terms of like the diesel. Yes, you can use vegetable oil, you can make biodiesel with that, but for gas burning engines, you can use ethanol.
Right.
And that is something that you can manufacture as well. And, so it's also a viable alternative for, complete societal collapse with, we're back in the 19th century kind of deal. And they have advantages and disadvantages of each. And which do you see as a better alternative, the biodiesel or producing your own ethanol for gas burning engines?
Long term reliability. I think diesel engines have a pretty proven track record of for running long hours. Almost all industrial machinery, and big boats and on tractors and that sort of thing, use the diesel engines for that long-term reliability and long life. So I think over the long term, it would be easier to maintain a diesel engine and keep it going, probably than a gasoline or ethanol. And the ethanol gas that we have now is really hard on engines, especially small engines like motorcycle and outboard engines.
Mm-hmm.
It's really bad if you leave it in, if you leave it in the carburetor for more than a couple of weeks without running the engine, you can have all sorts of problems. So, it really screws up, small engines in particular. So, I don't have any experience with, with using it in a full-size vehicle like that. The pure ethanol that way, other than what we get with the 10%, which is pretty much everywhere. I do know that screws up small engines really bad, though.
Right.
And I try to avoid, if I can avoid it, I always do. It's kind of hard to find, straight gasoline anymore.
Yeah, everywhere you go, it's pretty much 10% now. Yeah, a lot of people are complaining about that. And it's going to get higher, I think.
Probably.
85% of all of this country's corn production goes into ethanol, and I think it's just going to continue to increase. But yeah, there's just all kinds of things to consider. One of the things that I really dig about this book is that and something that really doesn't cross people's minds. I know it didn't really. I didn't really consider it too much, but you're a big proponent of bug out or aquatic vehicles as a bug out vehicle. And I know of your experience. For those of you who are listening, Scott's just a hardcore kayaker, and there's those considerations where you might find yourself in a situation where a waterway is your only means
of
escape.
What a lot of people may not consider is that, the water really takes you to the places where other people can't get. That's the first thing to think about. Stop and think on, how many people have a boat, in a given city. Probably less than 10% of the population has a boat, and think about how many cities, particularly in the eastern United States, are either on the coast or near a coast or a navigable river, depending on, navigable, determined by what size boat you're using. I mean, even a small creek can work if you're in a canoe or a kayak, but when you think about it, how few people have access to the water and how the water goes into places that are completely and totally undeveloped even today, we still have vast wetlands and swamps and marshes and just uninhabitable places, and all along the eastern seaboard and the Gulf Coast, there's hundreds and hundreds of barrier islands that are inaccessible by any kind of motor vehicle. Land-based vehicle, you can only get there by boat, so there are just lots and lots of places to hide away and get away. And the other advantage of being out there in a boat is that you have access to all the marine life and the resources of the coast or the rivers, the fish and the other aquatic plants and things. So survival, along a waterway is much easier for most people than it would be like in the mountains or desert or other interior areas. At least, in my experience, that's been the case. It's been much easier to travel along the water and also to stay hidden completely out of sight, even when, I wasn't bugging out, but I've done thousands of miles of kayaking, like from Canada through the heartland of the United States all the way down here to the Gulf Coast by way of the rivers, and, a lot of times I would paddle at night and just be completely unseen by people on the shore, and I could hear their conversations when I went by, it's just a very stealthy way to travel.
Hmm. Yeah, and stealth is definitely a consideration that you want to keep in mind when you're
putting out. And then other many times I've also camped along, rivers where a lot of other people were using the waterways, and if I was traveling at night and camping in the daytime, I would just pull the boat up in the woods in the daytime and set my camp up out of sight of the water and just be completely hidden. If you hear people going by all day, they'd never know I was there. And then when it got dark, I would be back on the water traveling again. I had to do that in a lot of places where camping was illegal, like on the coast of Florida, in the Florida Keys when I was kayaking through there. I was able to, stealth camp all through the Keys for over a month, just slipping out of the kayak and, without ever getting caught by Marine Patrol or anyone else, So it's definitely possible, certainly a great way to get away. But I also talk here in the book, I also talk about larger boats too, because it's a whole different class of boats. It's easy to conceal, but you can also go further and stay out there longer, on various types of liveaboard boats, sailing boats and other types of cruising boats that can carry, several months worth of provisions at a given time and allow you to even leave not just your immediate area, but to even leave the continent if you want to and go across an ocean or to another whole part of the world, So there's a lot to consider with bug out boats.
Yeah, and one of my questions, if we go back to the kayak for a second, when I think of a kayak, as far as, a bug out vehicle goes, I think, well, that's kind of limited. You're limited in the provisions that you can carry and the gear that you can carry with you. But I know that you've gone on some really long range kayak trips, and what would you say is your operational range as far as like being able to carry enough food and all the stuff that you need on a kayak trip?
That's a very good question because, you know, that operational range can vary depending on, like on a recreational kayaking trip, if you're on the coast, you know, traveling on salt water, you're obviously going to have to carry water as well as food, and water adds up, you know, a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. But, say, just in that scenario, you know, kayaking along a coast, you know, like the Florida coast or something, you know, you could easily travel, you know, a week to 10 days with the amount of water and food you could carry in the boat. But if you were looking at it, you know, in a truly bug-out type situation where, you know, you were really changing what you were carrying and you were actually foraging and maybe doing some supplemental hunting and fishing along the base, and then you only would have to carry things like rice and some other staples, and especially if you're on fresh water and you didn't have to carry your, you know, all your drinking water with you all the time, then you could probably extend that up to a month or more, you know, with just the basic staples like that and the gear that you would need to survive and live out of the kayak. Mm-hmm. Because a typical, you know, the kind of kayak I did my trip in, could easily carry around 400 pounds of equipment, you know, in addition to the paddler. So,
really?
You know, it gives you a good bit of range. I mean, not as much as a canoe, you know, some of the bigger canoes, but a lot of capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you mentioned, you know, a lot of your range would be limited by or determined by, you know, what other resources that you have around, you know, if you're going to, you know, fish or hunt your food, right. and then, you know, you don't need to carry that much, but 300 to 400 pounds of supplies you could in a kayak, you could reasonably.
Yeah. Carry. I mean, count, you know, your total load, count all your camping gear, you know, your equipment and your food and everything. But as I say, I've been able to work it out where I could stay out there for 3 to 4 weeks, you know, and on some of the trips I would carry, you know, a collapsible rifle like an AR-7 Explorer or something like that, or a 10/22, and I would do some small game hunting, and I did some fishing, and of course in the Caribbean I was doing underwater spear fishing, you know, for lobster and fish and things like that, and gathering shellfish and you know, doing lots of things to supplement what I carried in the kayak itself, but they're all. You know, they can get you into some places that are really optimal, you know, for that kind of foraging, too. I mean, you get to places where people in the bigger boats can't go, you know, the reefs that are not fished out and into remote lakes and places, you know, where you can really get some good hunting. And, I mean, just coming down the, you know, the rivers from Canada, you know, I came down the Red River of the North up the Red River of the North and then down the Minnesota and the Mississippi River, you know, thousands of miles of paddling inland like that in the United States. It was amazing how much game that you pass, you know, and you're so quiet and you're so low to the water in the kayak, you pass within easy range of deer and all kinds of game every day, you know, in those kind of situations. So it's very feasible to hunt right out of the kayak, you know, if you have a rifle and, you know, the means to do that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of larger boats, you can go up as big as, you know, a yacht or a houseboat,
right.
But you know, I would imagine that's not very practical in terms of like bug out and stealth and maneuverability and what have you. So where do you say a good, you know, comfortable middle ground is in terms of like realistic expectations and also in terms of, you know,
yeah, well, price? I did talk about both types. I mean, you know, there's a chapter on escape type boats and then also on the little board boats. So some boats that would be considered yachts would be a viable option, you know, depending on what your bug out plans are. For instance, you know, I used to have a 26-foot sailboat that, you know, had a cabin. It was a little board type sailboat, and you can pick up a boat like that cheaper than you can find an old Toyota pickup. You know, it's amazing how cheap these old vessels can be, and you do a little work on them, and you can actually live aboard the boat and go anywhere on it. So if you wanted a boat that you could bug out and actually leave the country on, you know, they're out there. You know, you can find a boat for under 10 grand that'll take you across the Atlantic Ocean or to South America or wherever you want to go. You know, of course, there's a learning curve there. You know, you got to acquire the skills of seamanship and navigation to do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not prohibitively expensive, you know. But looking at a middle ground between that type of boat and a kayak, you know, there's also, you know, boats, what I call beach cruising type boats, which are boats that can carry several people, you know, two or three people if you have a small family or something, and yet you can still camp aboard the boat. Some of these boats have a provision to set up a tent on board so you can get, like, back up into a swamp area and stay on board the boat, or you can camp ashore. So unlike a kayak, you know, it gives you that option, you know, to carry more stuff and carry more people, you know, because, you know, really a kayak is going to be a kind of a solo type endeavor, you know, unless you have, you know, all your family is in the kayaking as well.
Mm.
if you have a family, if you have small children, if you have, you know, disabled people or whatever, then you're going to want to consider some other type of boat. And then you get down to the, you know, where you're going to decide whether you want to use, you know, a gasoline-powered or diesel-powered boat versus a sail-powered vessel. And again, if we're looking at, you know, end-of-the-world type scenario or long-term grip down, you know, a sailing vessel, you know, can ride the wind for free and go as far as you want to go, as long as you want to go. So there's a lot of advantages to that. But there's also disadvantages, too, as with everything. You know, most sailing vessels are going to be harder to conceal, you know, because of the mast, for one thing, and then if there's not any wind, you're not going to go anywhere. So it all depends on where you are. You know, if you're in a coastal area where you can depend on the wind, and if you have the experience sailing, then there's lots of good options out there for that type of boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the good things, one of the things I like about your book is that you do point out the disadvantages as well as the advantages of all of the types of vehicles that you mentioned in here. And there's a drawback for everything in terms of bug-out vehicles. There's no, you know, one master solution, or you have to think about what type of situation you're going to be in. Obviously, you know, for somebody who's in a landlocked state, you know, somewhere in the Midwest, is, you know, they're not going to be thinking too much about a boat. But like you mentioned too, it's like a lot of it depends on, like, well, how bad is the situation really? I mean, is civilization never going to come back? Are we never going to have any more gasoline or anything like that? And as far as like leaving the country and everything out on the open ocean, I mean, that brings a lot of risks as well. That, you know, you, if you're inexperienced, then you might be better off just staying on land. You know, I've always been kind of a land person myself. You know, I've always been drawn towards the mountains and the deserts and everything like that. So I don't have a whole lot of experience as far as like watercraft and things like that go. But it's something that I'm keenly interested in. Where I live, there's water everywhere. There's lakes and rivers.
Yeah,
and
sure. You could take to the water and go over and, you know, go north into Canada. You know, lots of options, you know, from where you're located.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, unfortunately, because I'm such a geek, one of my favorite parts of your book were the ones about the part that covers vehicles as a shelter, things like box trucks and school buses and bread vans and things like that.
Yeah, I think the idea of a mobile retreat, you know, could be a really viable solution for a lot of people, because, you know, you just got to face the fact, you know, not everybody can put a backpack on and head off into the mountains, you know, with what they can carry on their back. And again, if you're, you know, if you're a family type situation, yeah, you have small children, you have somebody older in your family or disabled, then I think a mobile retreat starts to make a lot more sense, you know, because, you know, it's almost like a bug out location, almost like bugging in, but you have it, you know, you have a vehicle that's set up to live aboard, and you have all your stuff there, and you have your preparations for defending the vehicle, and you have your food and your supplies and your means of conveyance. So all in one. So, you know, you may not be going very far. You just want to get out to a safe location and get away from whatever situation you're in at the time, and have everything self-contained on that vehicle. So it's kind of a lot like the larger liveaboard boats that I talked about previously, you know, same situation as mm-hmm. on land.
Yeah, bread vans. I was a big fan of bread vans.
Yeah.
I never owned one myself, but I had a friend who had one, and it was like a mobile living room.
Sure.
it was pretty
special. Yeah, I've seen some fantastic conversions, you know, bread vans and different kinds of, you know, box trucks. And then I've seen some really good or really cool house trucks built onto the back of flatbed trucks or even trailers, you know, just, you know, built right up from scratch, you know, with a 2x4 framing like a conventional house or shed, you know.
You have one in here, the house truck that there's a couple of pictures that looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, a friend of mine built that. He's actually a boat builder and had a big job to do in San Francisco. He's based in Florida, and he took his whole crew out there to do this job, and they lived in this house truck, you know, while they were working on the job out there. So they used it to travel from Florida to California, do the job, and then go back, you know. So it worked out pretty well.
And even if you just have, like, a camper shell on the back of your truck, I mean, I lived in the back of my truck for months at a time. Like that, with just the just the standard shell. It was basic shelter. I only spent time in there when I was sleeping most of the time. But you know, that affords you, if you're a single guy, you know, or you're a single person, a single woman guy, you know, you can get by just swell with just a truck with the top on the back, and you got room for storage, you know, storing your food and your gear and all that other stuff, and plenty of room for sleeping. However, one thing that I will recommend is that if you're going to do that the bed of the truck, you need to lay something down there for insulation.
Yeah.
Boy, I didn't have that. I had an air mattress, and as a matter of fact, when the first time I went out, I had an air mattress in the back of that truck, and you'll get hypothermia will set in, and it wasn't even that cold outside. It wasn't like it was the middle of winter or anything like that, and I woke up just freezing and shaking and blue. Because that the conduction, it just sucks the heat right out of
yeah.
it, you know, through the bed of the truck.
Yeah, that's right. And so another thing I found out too, I lived in the back of a small van one time like that, you know, in hot weather or summertime, it's also really difficult to keep the mosquitoes out. So you want to have provisions, you know, for screens, because you got to open the windows and you have some ventilation in there. If you don't have a way to keep the mosquitoes mm-hmm. out, it's not the same as a tent, you know, because most tents are designed with that in mind. So coming from, you know, years and years of living out of tents, you know, doing my kayak trips, I wasn't expecting the difficulties, you know, living in the van, but it was a little different, and I had to make some modifications to make that work. But we did that as a couple, mm-hmm. you know, traveled all over New Mexico and Arizona, you know, for several weeks, living out of a small GMC van, and I built the bunks up over a box that had storage underneath it, so that did help with the insulation problem, you know, under there. But that ventilation was something that you know, had to be addressed, mosquito netting.
The area where I was living, the part of Arizona where I was mainly living out of the truck, was in northern Arizona up in the mountains, where it's pretty mild. You know, the summers aren't that hot and the winters don't get that cold. But whenever I would venture further south down into, you know, Tucson or, you know, in the hot desert region of the state, that truck became, you know, that bed of that truck with the camper shell on it became like an oven.
Yep.
And there are many, many a morning. I mean, like first thing in the morning, we're talking about, you know, when the temperature's already up there, and I would wake up gasping for air. I felt like I was suffocating because it was so hot in there. So, yeah, the ventilation is an important consideration, and with a mind towards keeping bugs out, if that's the bugs weren't, mosquitoes weren't really a big problem in the desert.
Right.
You know, there's no standing water or anything, but if you are, you know, anywhere near here, like up here in New Hampshire,
yeah.
Right now the black flies up here are horrific.
Right.
I mean, they're monsters. They're not like, you know, and they're just nasty.
Yeah, they plagued me on my kayak trip through, you know, Lake of the Woods and Lake Winnipeg, that area. I mean, just really horrific, like you say. I mean, it was just incessant, you know, all day long, you know, just being attacked by these things.
Yep, big problems. And oh boy, they hurt
yeah.
too. Their stings.
Yeah.
And raise a welt. I've got welts on my arms. I was out hiking over the weekend, and I've got some welts on my arms that still haven't gone away. They're still itchy and uncomfortable.
Right.
But you know, that's what you expect when you're outdoors.
Yeah.
You know, especially in the
yeah. More
rural areas.
Another thing, talking about that ventilation and you know, in a converted, you know, truck or something, another thing I'll point out in the book is, you know, you can make it a lot more habitable by having a 12-volt system in the, you know, like an RV, you know, not the main starting battery, but a separate house battery, you know, for running a 12-volt system, so you can have fans and lights and that sort of thing, and then maybe use
yep.
a solar panel to charge everything. So that's something that you would definitely want to consider if you're setting up a, you know, a homemade type or do-it-yourself bug-out vehicle like that, you know, as a mobile retreat. And I talk about some of those mm-hmm. considerations in the book, you know, and what kind of things that you need to think about on that.
Since we're talking about, like, the house truck and whatnot, and you do cover, you know, shelters and, you know, survival structures and everything like that, and the house truck kind of reminds me of something else that I've been kind of geeking out over. I don't know if you're probably aware of this whole tiny house movement.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Where people, those things are awesome. I know it's like it's such a geek thing to you know to get excited about. But, you know, I really like the idea of something that you can just put on a trailer, you know, and just take it with you wherever you go and just, you know, plant it wherever you, you know, well, wherever you can. Yeah, you warn about, like, you know, public land and stuff like that in your book. But boy, those things are great. And you go into all kinds of other stuff like yurts and, you know, another thing, yurts are something that I really dig as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what some of your favorite setups are?
Well, I mean, you know, of course, your greatest mobility is going to be your simple, you know, tent or tarp, you know, right out of a backpack, which is very primitive, you know, the most, you know, the roughest type of living that you can do, you know, which is what I talk about in my first book, of course, you know, the first bug out book. And that's basically, you know, what to carry in a backpack and where to go, you know, to basically just bug out into the wilderness sort of thing. So that's going to be your, you know, your ultimate mobility. You know, if you're living that way, you can pretty much go anywhere you want to go with a lot of flexibility. Sure. And as soon as you start increasing the complexity of your shelter, then, you know, things start changing then, you know, as far as, you know, your mobility. So I talk about in the book, you know, things like yurts and these large cabin type tents, you know, like the outfitter type hunting tents, you know, that you could set up in advance. You know, or you could carry it in if you had an ATV or maybe pack horse or animal, you know, some way to carry it in as you're going, or you may want to set it up in advance so that gives you a more permanent type shelter, especially for, you know, high mountain areas or cold climates where you're going to have to, you know, have a stove or a fireplace, you know, inside the shelter just to survive. So that's kind of the next level up from, you know, just living out of a backpacking type tent. But it's also going to be that extra weight and complexity to move it, and you're not going to put it in your backpack and walk off with it, you know, as you know. So that's a whole different kind of thing there. So, and then there's the natural type shelters. You know, I talk about that some in the book, you know, how you can modify. Like I found a cave in a really remote part of the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico that some guy had been living in, and he had built a, you know, a log palisade across the front. And there was evidence that someone had lived there for years, you know, that was probably back in the 1920s and 30s based on the, all the tobacco cans that I found around the fire pit, you know, that were dated from that time. So somebody had lived there for a pretty extended time in a very remote area, you know, remote location. And I just happened to stumble upon it, you know, by chance. So, you know, there are those kind of shelters. And then I also talk about shelters you could build, you know, from scratch, you know, in the wilderness, you know, different types of things, elevated type, like here in the south, you know, in the swamps that you could get, you know, in some of the really remote wetland areas and build something up off the ground, you know, in the trees, you could pretty well, you know, stay hidden as long as you wanted to, because you get into places that people can't even go, you know, if you get there, you know, in a canoe or other small boat.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, yurts, I can only speak from, you know, my experience out west in the northern deserts. I knew a few people who had built a yurt out there, and they were building on land that they probably shouldn't have. It wasn't land that they owned, right. But, you know, out there after a while, you're like, well, you know, who's really going to come and, you know, give me a hassle about this? You know, you're really out in the middle, literally out in the middle of nowhere. And I think if the shit hit the fan, then, you know, I wouldn't be too worried about it either, you know, because we're talking like really unforgiving environment.
Yeah, the West. I mean, there's so much land like that in the West. I mean, definitely if I were in the western part of the United States, that would be the kind of place I'd be scoping out for a bug out location. I mean, it's a lot of those places that I have spent a lot of time in, you know, in some kind of shelter like that I could, you know, winter over in, or, you know, you could disappear out there pretty easy, as you know.
The only thing that, you know, this is my dilemma. I mean, just from a personal, from a purely emotional standpoint, I would go back to Arizona in a heartbeat. I mean, there's not a day goes by I don't think about it. That's a place, that's a part of the country that I really felt most comfortable and happiest. But, and the other thing that I did enjoy about it as well is that, you know, you can go out there and be anonymous. You can go out there and, you know, and nobody will ever see you again. And that's the reason why a lot of people go out there. I, you know, that's one of the things. I wouldn't say that I was, a textbook definition, you know, I wasn't a hermit or a misanthropic by any sense, but I also like the fact that I could just disappear. And, you know, it felt, that's freedom to me, you know. But On the other hand, you know, yeah, great place to bug out to, but you have to worry about water.
Right, yeah, water is a very limiting factor out there, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people who do live out, you know, and they set up a homestead or something like that, you know, out in the backcountry, they've got to have their water trucked in because there's no, you know, resources. And up on the Mogollon Plateau, you're right on top of bedrock, so you can't really – there are no wells. You know, there's no possibility of drilling a well just because of the geology. And so that is what's you know holding me back from going out there because you know if we do go past that tipping point and everything and it's going to be rough living for those homesteaders out there who are relying on their water deliveries when that stops you know they're going to have to pick up and find some other just out of pure necessity they're going to have to abandon their homesteads and go and find another place where they can survive.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so,
I mean, you will find water in some of the mountain areas out there, but there's so many places that there's not water. I mean, that would be a real problem. As you said, people that are homesteading in a place like that would have to move.
There are some exceptions. When I lived like to the extreme northern part of the state, out the near the Vermilion Cliffs area, we got all of our water from runoff.
Right.
From off the cliffs, and so yeah, if you can find yourself in a situation like that. Then that's great, but otherwise, yeah, you're in for a dry, dangerous time.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to the end of our time here, unfortunately. It always goes by far too quickly, and I just want to give our listeners a heads up, let them know that they can get your book, Bug Out, Vehicles and Shelters, right at survivalandbeyond.net. You can go there and just click on the banner there, and you're all set. Highly recommend the book. And while you're at it, check out his other book called Bug Out, which is a comprehensive book on everything you need to consider about bugging out, in terms of bugging out, and you know, gear, supplies, the realities of it, the factual considerations. And Scott, you're also working on another book right now. We got a couple minutes left. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Well, I actually have one that I've completed that's in the publication process right now. It will be scheduled to be released in July, but I think it may actually become available in June. It seems like it's a little bit ahead of schedule, but it's actually a novel. This is my first novel after writing 7 nonfiction books, and this is a scenario where the grid goes down all across North America. So a lot of the things that I talk about in the nonfiction books, you know, this novel shows, you know, how the characters are placed in this situation and how they survive, and it involves, you know, it's kind of an adventure novel, and it involves, you know, some sailing and boating and kayaking and canoeing type stuff, and, you know, bugging out of a city. Actually, part of it is set in New Orleans, and part of it is set in the Caribbean islands, and it ends up in the swamps of Mississippi, where, you know, my home state, which I'm intimately familiar with, so that's my most... you know, exciting project for a while. The name of the book is The Pulse, the novel of survival after the collapse of the grid. So I'm going to be posting something about that shortly on my blog, and it's already available, you know, on Amazon. You can find the title on Amazon. It's available for pre-order, but it will be released in July at the latest.
Awesome. That sounds great. And you 7 books, huh? I knew that you've written several books. I didn't realize that you've written that many.
Yeah, the previous books were, you know, before I started writing the survival books, so the other books were about my, you know, kayaking experiences, and one book is a boater's guidebook to the barrier islands of Mississippi, you know, and the bays and river right, you know, the coast of Mississippi. So that's more of a guidebook. That was actually my first book, and then I wrote a travel narrative about the kayak trip and another travel narrative about one of the rivers here in Mississippi that's kind of an ecological treasure that very few people know about outside of the region. So I co-authored that with a friend of mine. But then I'm also currently working on, I will be in the next few months working on 2 more survival books that will accompany these other books. And the third one is going to be, the second one of those books is going to be a third series, you know, the Bug Out series. It's actually going to be another book in the Bug Out series covering some other topics. So that one will be out in 2013 sometime.
Wow, that sounds great. No, there's an awful lot to draw from there, folks. So go ahead and check them all out. And Scott, thanks a lot. It's always great to have you on the show. I'm glad you're on here with us to tell us about all this Great bug out vehicle information. I know our listeners really enjoy it.
I enjoy talking to you, Ed, and thanks for having me again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Scott. Well, that'll about do it for this installment of Survival and Beyond, broadcasting on the Natural News Radio Network and also shouting out to you from the Prepper Podcast Radio Network. I want to thank you all for listening. Thanks for tuning in. And when you have a chance, come and check out the website at survivalandbeyond.net and check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/survivalandbeyond and all that good social media stuff and everything. I'd be happy to hear from you. So take care, everybody. Until next time, keep your head up. Keep on living free.